Hello, everyone. Welcome to Form of Passion, episode 72. I want to thank you once again for joining us. This is Ace Stallings. And this particular episode was being recorded in the Bay Area as well as Portland. I'll start with the top of the episode. We have a very special guest, a Gen 1 hardcore punker, Mr. Jerry A. of Poison Idea fame, graced us for this interview. And I got to tell you, this is outstanding. I haven't gotten to do kind of like a monologue in the beginning here separately from doing the episode. I usually kind of just go off the dome, do the monologue while the person's on the line and then start interviewing them. So I wanted to take this instance to, you know, where we're doing a separate one to kind of, do a little bit of house cleaning, a little bit of how you doings and, not make up for lost time on doing these longer ones, but, just cram some stuff in. For those who don't know, myself and Sam have been involved in this. My band, Mutually Assured Destruction, recently dropped pre-orders for our debut LP on Triple B Records. The record is called Ascension. It'll be out in full on May 18th, but you can listen to the first single off of that record called Spirit Liberation on all streaming services, as well as pre-order the LP at www.triplebrecords.net. The song features a guest spot by an alumnus of this podcast, Mr. Randy Blythe of Lamb of God fame. Check it out. He kills it. Sam recorded the record. It's amazing. And I feel not arrogant saying that because I truly do believe it's the best piece of music that I've gotten to be a part of and some of Sam from Forum's best production work. So check out that new song, pre-order the record. I look forward to everybody hearing it. I appreciate everybody that supports my band, as well as this particular endeavor of being the podcast. Also, while I have everybody's attention here, we are just a couple days short of the 1 month mark from the festival I'm doing in Richmond, Virginia on the weekend of 5/20 through 21. That's going to be at that's the big takeover that I'm doing with Sam Yarmuth of Triple B Records. That's happening at the Camel and Broadberry and the Warehouse in Richmond. If you have not checked out the lineup for that yet, for whatever strange reason, I recommend going to the Richmond Hardcore Show's Instagram and checking that out. It features some of my current favorites in hardcore, punk, and metal. I'll list off a few, and if it sounds like something that will be fun for you to make the trip to Richmond that weekend, or perhaps you're a Richmond or Virginia resident and you haven't gotten your tickets yet, might push you to do it if I talk to you about it in kind of a condensed fashion here. But we got Genocide Pact, Terrorizer, Restraining Order. We got Mind Force, Division of Mind, Dead Heat, Bib, Spy, C4, Gel. Got Vomit Forth on this one. End It. There's Nosebleed, Violent Way. And this is just across all three of the shows. And I'm probably only seeing a third of the bands playing. So if you like any one of those bands and want to come to Richmond or in Richmond and want to have a good weekend, hit that weekend up. You can get tickets at the Richmond Hardcore Show's Instagram, or you can go to the Broadberry website or the Camel website and pick some up. It's going to be a great time. The shows are selling well. Day one is certainly going to sell out, and day two might or get very close. Going to be a good weekend. I'm looking forward to doing this annually. Also, for those that support this podcast, as you know, if you've listened before, you can support this podcast by subscribing to our Patreon feed. And that's not just giving us money. You're going to be getting an additional episode each month away from the two mainline episodes on the last Friday of each month. That's going to be at www.patreon.com/forum of passion. You can subscribe for $2, not two additional, but $2 there. Or you can subscribe for additional money if you want to give more. A lot of people usually do, and we appreciate it. At the top of each mainline episode, we like to shout out the people that have subscribed since last time. So if you do subscribe, then you're going to get a shout out. And if I recognize the name and know about any endeavors, projects, bands, whatever that you're in, I'm going to shout that out on here as well. This episode is being recorded a little bit sooner since the last one. So we've only got one name this week. That's Carl Marquez. Thank you very much, Carl. But, you know, usually there's a handful each time. There's great stuff going on over there at the Patreon. You're going to get access to all the backlog episodes as well. So, you know, it's not just going to be like all the new ones that come out. You're going to have access to the library. We appreciate everybody that keeps this podcast afloat over there. You guys are the real heroes of hardcore punk and metal. And, you know, I just can't stop myself from saying thank you every time I'm talking about, you know, things going on over at the Patreon, because it really does help out. This operation is a bi-coastal operation, and it does require some moving and shaking to keep rocking. I want to say today's episode is one that gets deep. It's one that gets very real. And I really appreciated Jerry being able to be vulnerable enough to do that. He's a legend. Poison Ideas is legendary, informative. And to have them be a part, have him and the Poison Ideas story be a part of the Forum catalog is something that I would never have thought was something that was going to be attainable at the onset of this podcast. So without further ado, here's the story of Jerry A. of Poison Idea. Jerry, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. A pleasure to have you.
Cool. Great being here. Thanks.
You know, I've always, you know, I want to say that for this podcast, you might be one of the first or like near the first, like kind of like generation one hardcore people that we've had on. So I know the history is long, and you know, I've grown up listening to Poison Idea and paying attention to, you know, like y'all's legacy and you know, discography and stuff, and I've always known y'all to be like, you know, a staple in Portland. Is that where you originally hailed from?
Yeah, it's, you know what, it's nice being thought of as a OG punk, because, you know, because there really is a pecking order. There always has been. It's really a clicky thing, you know. And I remember being like a kid, like 15, looking in and seeing the older punks and thinking I would never be, you know, but it's cool to be thought of as, you know,
you definitely are
round one. Yeah. So I grew up, I was born in Eugene, Oregon, down south, about 100 miles. And as soon as I could, I learned how to walk in Eugene. And then as soon as I learned how to run, I ran to Portland as fast as I could. Yeah. When I was like 15, like I said, and, you know, jumped right into it.
Okay. So you were in Eugene for like the kind of like your younger formative years.
Yeah. And that was cool too, because it was a college town. Got it. And so they had, you know, rock and roll coming through there all the time.
Were you like playing music when you were in Eugene, or did that not start until you got to Portland?
Well, my parents were divorced, and my mom lived in Missoula, Montana, which was another college town that had a, you know, a circuit of rock and roll. And I met a kid there who, a little hoodlum who ripped off a church and stole a bunch of musical gear from a church and gave me my first bass. So, I mean, I was playing, but I didn't know how to like tune it or, you know, but I could play songs on one string. I could play the whole complete songs, like whatever, like a Ramon song or something on one string. But, you know, the stuff we were jamming on when I was a kid was, it like today it would be called like, I don't know, noise progress, like Smegma type stuff. It was crazy. We'd have like whatever, like a busy signal on a phone for like a beat. You know, it was like, bah, 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 bah. We're like, boom, doo, 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 like that, playing along to either or a fan or just all sorts of crazy noise, and then we would like just use like feedback over the top of it, and it sounded crazy. It was like, like, you know, suicide or something, you know.
How had you discovered kind of like, because you said like it's like rock and roll had been coming through and stuff, but how had you discovered like bands like Smegma and things of that nature?
Well, they're from Portland. Yeah. So yeah, when I moved to Portland, it was, you know, they would have shows and whoever it was, like Ice Nine and, you know, Sado Nation, and then like, you know, opening would be like Smegma and you know, the Stiff Noise or something like that. So, excuse me. And luckily a lot of that stuff was kind of documented. I mean, there were so many bands that came and went. I mean, I was like in three or four bands that just blew past and, you know, in a couple months, but we never recorded anything.
Right.
And that's the way that scene was, you know, with like Ziplocs, you know, whatever. There was all sorts of punk in Portland, but it just kind of, it was like a, so it was like a burning star. It just like so bright and so hot, and it burned out quick and went on to the next thing.
Would bands like what exist for like, what, like a few months and then just kind of form into something else?
Yeah, I mean, there was a band in Portland called The Fix, as it was in Lansing too, and I think England or wherever, but and they were really good. They were like a three-piece band, and they were kind of like, they were like melodic, kind of like cross between like The Clash and The Germs, I thought.
And okay, cool.
They were really cool. And that was a, you know, one of my favorite bands at one time. And then, like I say, like, you know, Ice Nine was here, and the first show I saw in Portland was going to, I think it was the Wipers' first show in Portland.
I was gonna ask if they were around like at that time.
Yeah, I saw their first show, and you know, the, I always tell people that the punk like in Portland was people look like they got their clothes from like Goodwill, and like kind of looked like almost like the English, like the Liverpool Manchester scene, because
sure,
it's shitty here and rains all the time, and so everybody's wearing like overcoats, like raincoats. Mm-hmm. And then Seattle, they're like leather jackets and like kind of like greasers.
Got it.
That was the difference between these two scenes. And the Portland, you know, there was like fashion, of course, like, you know, the green hair or whatever. And I went to that, my very first show, and there was, you know, spray painted clothes and all this crazy people, and then the Wipers come up, and they're wearing like kind of like bell bottoms and you know, Dave the bass player had like cowboy boots on, and you know, and I was like, whoa. And but they played, and you know, they just blast out like, you know, a fast Yardbird song and just kick ass, and it was, so that they were my favorite band right away.
You know, had you already moved there, or was this before you moved there?
No, I moved here.
Okay, and so it was like your first gig after living there.
Yeah.
Before you were like listening to punk, what kind of music were you into when you were younger?
When I lived with my mom in Missoula, I would hit this record store downtown, this college record store, and I would bug them all the time. I was, you know, like 10 years old, and I'd bother them all the time. And finally, they were just like, I had long hair, and I'd wear like a Budweiser shirt or a, you know, a Diddy Wad Diddy, that Captain Beefheart song. And so they thought I was kind of cool, like this hippie kid, you know. And so they would have me wear like a billboard and go downtown on Saturday afternoons and hand out like 10% off coupons to these people to like try to like be like, you know, roll up. And they would pay me in records.
Okay.
They'd give me, yeah, so every day they give me like a used record or whatever, like, you know, $3 or whatever a record was back in those days. And so I, you know, of course I was into Bowie when I was a little kid. I loved, you know, like Diamond Dogs and that was, you know, On Back. And then I kind of, through that, I kind of got into like the old glam stuff, like, you know, Roxy Music and Sparks and stuff like that. It was,
sure,
even though I was like this kid, it was in like Montana, it was kind of like transported me to like this glamorous place that I could, you know, it was like a fairy tale, you know, being into like Queen and stuff like that, you know. And through all these bands like Bowie, through Bowie you get into Mott the Hoople and you get into the Stooges, and you know, through Roxy Music and stuff you find, you know, like Eno and you know, it's crazy, it's all those off the family trees, you know. So that's kind of, you know, I remember when I lived in Eugene a couple of years later, I stole this record out of a Fred Meyer or Kroger or whatever. It was it had Jimmy Page on the cover of it, and it showed him in his like dragon uniform, and he's like playing his guitar. And I was looking at it, and I was like, wow, I've never seen it. Because I was in Zeppelin, of course, like all children were. And
yeah.
I didn't know what it was, and I brought it home, and it's like, in little teeny writing, it was like, Sonny Boy Williamson featuring Jimmy Page. It was like some session stuff he did when he was like a kid, like for Sonny Boy Williamson. And I was like, what the hell is this? This isn't Led Zeppelin. But I listened to it more and more, and I was like, oh, well, that's where Led Zeppelin got their songs from. That's where,
right.
So I looked at the other people they put out, and it was like, Howlin' Wolf,
yes.
All this stuff. And I was like, oh, interesting. I wonder what this sounds like. And I listened to it, and I'm like, wow, this is a Led Zeppelin song. And I'd look at the Led Zeppelin record, like, why doesn't it say that? Why doesn't it say, Killing Floor by Howlin' Wolf? Yeah. And I was like, that's strange. And so I got into it through that. And I was, and through in like Zeppelin, I got a Fairport Convention and all through the, rabbit hole. But it's, people say it's all been done before, I guess. It's,
I feel like that's the thing too. And I'm curious, because we're going to get to this with when we do get to the Poison Idea portion of your life. But it's like, it is interesting, especially the formation of genres or kind of like revolutionary sounds or whatever. I feel like oftentimes are taking something that already kind of exists and sort of repackaging it and like adding some like different flair to it or whatever, like Zeppelin taking all those old blues songs and what have you, or I want to say like one of their tracks is like Blind Willie McTell or something like that. Just like, it's so many of those were just like covers of old ones, just kind of done with a different flair, whatever. Sure. And it appeals to somebody that maybe otherwise wouldn't have like gotten into it. So I see that you're kind of doing this crate digging with like finding records, looking in like liner notes and like making connections and everything to kind of find new music.
Well, yeah. I mean, like earlier today, I was driving in my car and I was listening to like the first couple Beatles albums.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, Little Richard, there's
a
little
thing
out there. And
that's right.
It's all, they're redoing this stuff. And yeah, sure. It's all, that's what, like you said, when we get to the Poison Idea stuff, that's what we, because we were making our own scene, we didn't have, it wasn't LA here, but we would, we first couple shows we played when Tom got in the band, we were playing a Black Flag song and a Serpent Jerk song and these songs, and we even did like a Mentally Ill song, and we were just doing all sorts of stuff. We were like a, a punk jukebox, and then we kind of, and then Discharge and whatever, and we were into Syd Barrett too, so we were just kind of throwing everything in there.
Sure. Sure. And you spend your time in Eugene, you go to Portland, like when you said you were like 15, were you in school, or were you like, fuck all that, I'm like going off on my own? Like, was it like a family thing, or was it just a kind of like a solo journey for yourself?
Well, like I said, my mother was, my parents were divorced when I was eight, and I stayed under my parents' houses until I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the deal was, every year I would go back and forth. I would stay with my mom for one school year, and then she's like, fuck this, I don't want him anymore, you take him. And my dad would have me for a year, and then he'd go, I don't want him anymore, you take him. So I was going back and forth constantly. And my mother moved to Portland from Missoula when I was 15, and I was with my father my first year of high school, and I was 14, and he's like, go back to her. And I went back here, and then I was like, I'm done bouncing around, I'm gonna go do this by myself. And so I split and went and lived in a punk house. Watching job.
Broke off there. So yeah, like found a job for yourself, started, kind of like, living with people in the scene and whatnot. That all makes sense. You said you made bands when you got there, but they would all be kind of like short lived, or was there something that ended up kind of being like substantial right about when you got there?
No, it was kind of like, I would, what I would yes, would be kind of like a high school experience where you would get together at parties and like, you know, you want to be in my band. I'm starting a band. I had a couple bands like that that didn't even play. We had bands that we would just like write our name on walls and stuff. And we're like, you know, and the first Poison idea, I was in a bunch of bands actually playing. But the first Poison idea band was, I would go around and find these guys that all looked like Paul Simonon from The Clash. There's guys in like leather jackets. I was like, hey, do you want to be in my band? You look cool. You look like, you know, you look cool. You look cool. So I assembled this band of these like leather guys, like these four leather guys. And I'm like, hey, we're Poison Idea, you know? And they're like, wow, you look cool, but what's your music sound like? I'm like, well, we've never played before. We just, you know, look like a bunch of punks with all these four Sid Vicious guys, you know?
At what age were you doing, like, had you kind of come up with the idea, no pun intended, of doing Poison Idea?
Well, I was in, like I said, I was in a bunch of bands, and I think the last band before I was in PI was, I think it was Jungle Nausea. They were kind of like that's when the Contortions were busting big, and that kind of that, you know, James Blood Ulmer stuff and the funk punk shit with the saxophone and and it was, so I was kind of like a tribal funky, you know, band, and I was in these bands and I was like, you know what, I could be a better singer than that. Because I'd see, you know, Black Flag would come through, DOA, all these bands would come through all the time because we had Vancouver and Seattle,
and then we
were right in the middle, and then below is San Francisco and LA, so people would come over. I mean, be it the Undertones or whoever from England, these, you know, English bands would come over. And at that time there was, you know, like all the new wave stuff, like Elvis Costello, Blondie, Devo, all that shit was coming through all, like every month there would be somebody new like that.
Right.
But, you know, in Vancouver, there was, like I say, the Pointed Sticks, DOA, Subhumans, Young Canadians, all that stuff would come down. And then in Seattle, it was like Soldier and the Farts just started. And then down south, you know, it was all the Danger House bands. They all came up through here. Everyone, the Weirdos, the Screamers, Negative Trend. I think the Alley Cats never did. The Zeros came through.
Okay.
Because they'd go to Vancouver, because Vancouver is a big, giant, you know, they had a really hop and scene with like I said, DOA and stuff.
Yeah, around DOA and stuff, sure.
Yeah, so everybody would come through and they would stop in Portland. So we got to see all those bands, you know, and they would have whatever record. And so I knew what was going on. I knew what time it was watching, you know, because Black Flag came through here with Ron Reyes.
Okay, so early, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, we were like, wow, so this is what we like. This is the shit. You know, then they came through with Dez like three or four times with Dez, and we kind of just accepted them as the people's band because they were just like the band that represented, you know, so everybody wanted to be like Black Flag was the shit.
And understandably so.
Yeah. So then when I started Poison Idea, I'm like, you know what, these guys are doing this. I want to be like this. I want to do this. And like I say, in the we were into whatever D beat and New York stuff.
That in there too. Cause I think when you referenced Discharge earlier, I was like, you know what? I never really thought about that parallel, but I definitely hear that in PI.
Sure. Sure. I mean, you know, even before Discharge, it was like, you know, we were into Sabbath and stuff as little kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that whole, yeah, that burning or yeah, all that stuff it's ingrained, you know, and if you're trying to do what you know, and speak the language, you know, that's what it's in your blood. So it just makes sense, you know? And so And then, like you said, we emulated what we got us off, but we kind of threw in our own touch of, you know, the Northwest. And like with Tom and me, we just like all sorts of just like, you know, he was like into, you know, Paul Kossoff and, you know, just, you know, Martha Hoople and just old classic rock and roll. He just loved it so much. And he knew.
Yeah. There's a lot of rock in there. If I, for certain, you know, almost more so than other hardcore bands of the time, in my opinion. Cause y'all weren't afraid of solo work and stuff. Like Whereas like some other bands, like Black Flag did that, but Greg Ginn had a very particular style that wasn't, I wouldn't really call it rocking, you know?
Sure.
So yeah, it's like, yeah. I hear that in PI.
Yeah. So yeah, it's like you say, just add, you know, your own thing, but just, yeah. So that's, we can play with solos, you know, it's hard to, in a 30 second song, to have a solo in there.
But, yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
So. No, so, but like, but so this was, what were you like 17, 18 when PI started?
Let me see, think for just a second. We did our first show on, it was like New Year's Eve of 80 to 81. So yeah, I was 16 going on 17.
Okay. So you had only been in Portland for
a year.
Yeah, for a year. Okay. So started pretty quickly. What was, you know, kind of like that, those like the first show and those early experiences, you know, what was kind of like, how was the operation? How did it feel? Did people immediately take to it, or did it like take a little bit of time?
Well, there were a couple. When I first started going to shows like that Wiper show, there were maybe like two other people my age, like 15, in the scene.
Okay.
By the time I was 16, it was really blowing up. The kids from like the suburb Beaverton were coming into shows. The downtown, school, the art school, the MLC, the school. Those kids were doing it. The other person who was my age was, the singer in the Neo Boys. She was like my age. And so she brought all her friends in. And they played at the school one evening. And this band from the school opened up for them. And they were called The Tents. And it was Chris Tents and his people. And he was like 3 months younger than me. And so that was kind of a novelty thing for these people, that this young kid was out there playing guitar and singing. And so I was, you know, wow, you're my age, let's hang out and get drunk, you know, and whatever. And so we just started. And then it was weird, like within 6 months with these people in all these different areas, it just kind of just grew. We just see people, you know, within a year, it was big enough to have its own like club in Portland. And that was one thing too that was really crazy about this town here, was the people like Fred from Dead Moon, this guy Mark Sten, Fred Noyes, who ran this club. They would do shows with all those bands I talked about from LA, but they were always underage shows. That was their one thing. They always had to be all ages. Yeah. So the Portland scene, I mean, there was a couple bar shows. I mean, the Dictators came through and played this bar, and you know, everybody stood outside and listened. You know, the first time the Ramones came, they played a bar, and everybody stood out. You know, the kids who were under 18 or whatever. But we were kind of spoiled in that way, that I took it for granted. I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I just assumed that all
it was like that were everywhere. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't. You know, and DC was the thing with the X's on the hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why they did that, and that was a pretty ingenious, you know,
thing. Sure. Oh, I mean, yeah, it started a whole thing with that too, you know. Yeah. I never thought about that. like how because like it's like me growing up, all ages venues were fairly prevalent. And again, maybe I was spoiled, you know, like because I grew up in Virginia, and like, you know, there was like a venue every block that like people under 21 could go to, but it may not have been like that everywhere. And it's interesting that you say when you first started going to Portland that you were like one of the younger people at the time. Like, you know, were people like college age when you first got there, or were they like kind of like later high school or something?
Yeah, high school. And, you know, at least, like I said, I was, you know, we weren't like, you know, bumping cocks or anything, but it was like, we just knew that every, you know, there was kids, they were driving. They were, to put it that way, they were driving cars. Right. And I was like, wow, you know, and there was people drinking and stuff, and there were, you know, people like starting families or whatever. So we, you know, punk couples and stuff like that, where I was like a dorky kid. And, Yeah, but once that thing, like the next year, like I said, the next 6 months, then it just blew up and there were kids everywhere. And it was, you know, and then the skate thing came in too, the crossover, because it was a very physical thing with the skate, you know, the California. A couple kids from L.A. moved up here and they were into the, you know, the whole whatever. Who was the big skater that time? Dwayne Peterson? I don't know. Whoever was the big punk skater in L.A. and stuff. And so they brought that up here and it was the big, you know. And there was no, like, pipes, half pipes or anything in Portland.
Yeah.
A lot of just street skating and stuff. So it was, that was a useful, you know, because, like, you know, the older people weren't skateboarding, you know.
Right.
So it was
So you know, kind of like that energy sort of gets brought in there. So when PI starts, it's like there's kind of like a, there's a good energy about the whole scene in Portland, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good time. I mean, you know, I can, somewhere around here is like a picture from our first show and the person took the photo from the back and it just showed, like, you could see the kids, the kids watching us. And even though some of those kids weren't in bands at the time, they started right away. As soon as we started bands, they started bands.
And, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to ask, did you guys play mainly like locally at first, or did you like, you know, be like, all right, like, you know, like, let's try to kind of hit this like West Coast circuit as quickly as we can? Or was it just kind of more about like, we just want to play. We don't really care about getting out of town yet.
We played in Portland. We do garage shows, house parties, basement shows, like every month we would be playing open mics. If there was like a venue that had an open mic thing, we would play. And we didn't, well, for one thing, none of us drove. We were like still pretty young. Then Tom got in the band and he was older, you know, he was a couple of years older than me and he did have a car. So we started going to Seattle.
Right.
And within like 3 months, I would go to Seattle to see shows anyway. Like one of my bands, I was in The Stand. We played in Seattle with the Neo Boys and I met all the guys that were in the Soldier at that time. And so I would go up there, I'd hitchhike up to Seattle and see every time a band would play, I would go to the show box or whatever and see these bands. And I got to know these kids and, Paul quit Soldier and started the Farts. Mm-hmm. And so then I was like, well, you guys want to play in Portland with us? So we, you know, it's like, we can give you $50 or whatever to come down here. And we were like trying to really make our nut, you know, we were like counting beans at the door, you know, like, whew, we made $50. Great. You know, we could pay these guys 50 bucks. And so that kind of was, that was kind of the community there with Seattle, but it was Seattle at first, Eugene a couple times. And, that was it because San Francisco is like,
far.
It's like 12-hour drive.
Yeah. It's far.
Yeah. So, it took us a long time before we played Seattle or excuse me, San Francisco. It took us a couple of years.
You guys do your first record in 83. And so that would have been like a couple years after you guys had started as a band.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
How did that come together in all?
What do you mean, the record or?
Well, yeah, the record. I mean, like, it's like the kind of your recording process, the record. Like, I can't remember distinctly, but I can't remember if you guys did that yourselves or did somebody locally or elsewhere be like, oh, we want to kind of put this out for you. Like, what sort of was the game plan there?
We were collecting records from everywhere. And there was a person in Portland. Well, there was a Joe Carducci who moved to LA and started working with SST. He did a radio show here and he was playing, like I say, he was playing all the everything, the Rough Trade stuff, everything. But he was playing a lot of, you know, like Tooth and Nail when that would come out. He would play that. So we knew about, you know, Upsetter Records and we knew about Danger House. And then when we started getting the Discord stuff and the Black Flag stuff, we did exactly like in that one documentary where we took the single and cut it apart and looked at it and figured out how to paste it together with glue.
Yeah.
And we knew a drug dealer who had money And we borrowed like however much money we need. We called the found pressing plants in the phone book. I think it was Rainbow in Los Angeles. And I mean, you know, that one record came out by Desperate Bicycles that showed you kind of how to do a record yourself. It was like, you know, this is what you do to get this mastered, recorded, you lacquered, played to do this. And it kind of is a blueprint. And we did that. We sent away, they sent us back the records. We, excuse me. The funny part is with the Pick Your King is we wanted on clear vinyl. We thought it'd be, you know, because records were kind of, you know, this one was a picture disc and it was really a, you know, UK subs, every single was, you know, they had a single on red, blue, green, brown, pink. And we were just like, wow, we're trying to collect them, you know, buy them. And
yeah,
they were,
everything. You know,
yeah. So we wanted it on clear vinyl, the first Pick Your King. And we put in our order and the pressing plant called us and said, you guys wanted clear, right? And we were like, yeah, yeah, clear. They go, well, we pressed 600 on black. And we said, no, we want them clear. We said, we speculated this is clear. They're like, ah, fuck, okay. Okay, give us another week. And so then in a week, we got your records. You know, we paid for them. They came up here. We took the paint. We know we Xeroxed the two-sided Xerox to the sheets. Or actually, it was one-sided that time because we cut them, glued them. Man, it took a long time. And we thought there has to be an easier way to do this because we actually glued them by hand.
Yeah.
And we set, and we, you know, like the Negative Approach single where they like drew inside of everyone. Mm-hmm. And we did stuff like that. And it took a couple months and they sold pretty good around Portland. And, you know, somebody would buy some, whoever people, you know, Mordam or whoever was around would buy this and that jam. And we sold out and then we called the pressing plant and said, you still got those records kicking around, those 600?
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, yeah, so we'll take them. So we got the second pressing, but in reality, the first pressing was the black ones.
Because interesting.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Oh. So then we got that and then we sold all of those. And then the Picture King just kind of kept, I mean, we pressed it, I don't know, whatever, 6-7 times, but,
yeah,
but the first ones. Yeah. So that's how we, you know, and we paid the drug dealer's money back. And so he didn't kill us.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. And so everything was, that's how we started. And then, you know, we kind of, you know, we didn't make the best business decisions when we were, you know, we just kind of were burning through.
Kids,
we
didn't expect, you know.
Yeah, we didn't expect it to last, you know, we just thought whatever. But yeah, so the next one we did ourselves too. And then we just kind of just nature.
What was the next record after that? Was that, I mean, because I'm looking through here, it's like, you know, I see Pick Your King being the first one. What came after Pick Your King?
We did Record Collectors.
That's right. Okay, I saw that here, and I wanted to make sure. Okay, yeah. So you that's your first 12-inch, and you do that the year after.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. Are you noticing, like, I mean, I know you guys, it's going to take a couple of years for you guys to kind of get out of Portland or whatever, but are you noticing like more of like an uptick in like people coming to see you guys locally once these records start coming out, or was it kind of the same?
You know what? The records then and now, you listen to them and it's an acquired taste. I mean, people aren't going to that blast beat, that's fucking screaming, you know, the aggro and the intensity. The kids liked it. I mean, there's yeah. And some older people that were thought it was like pretty crazy and you know, like whatever, like the Fugs or whatever. It's, they thought it was like, this is insane, and they liked the energy and stuff like that. But it was, I think we started attracting more and more crazy kids, but it was, you know, pretty insane. And then also when our record came out, that's when people started coming through Portland and we started opening up for every band.
Gotcha. Like who were you opening up for?
Well, of course, Black Flag, Dead Kennedys, DOA, yep. Bad Brains, Battalion of Saints, Raw Power. When the East Coast bands like AOD would come out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
You know, Corrosion of Conformity, they're out here. all those, you know, Agnostic Front first time they came out. So whenever there were, it was funny because Tom, he had the connections, and they would call him and like, you know, could you set us up a show? And he's like, well, sure, but you know, we can play with you. And so we started jumping on all the shows.
Right.
And you know, then we'd stay at our house, you know, the bands. And I remember like Raw Power came through that one summer, and they stayed at Tom's house for like 2 or 3 nights because their next show was, you know, a week away and wherever. And they just hung out there, and we, you know, got to know them and party with them every night. And then they were getting ready to pack up, and Tom goes, well, you know what? You guys stayed here for 3 nights. He's like, why don't you go downstairs in the practice room and set up and blast some songs for us?
Man,
so we would like do that. You know, we'd like, Raw Power was in the basement. We watched them like for, you know, 5 people.
That's killer.
Like that. Yeah.
Love so that.
Yeah.
So you guys are all living together as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. Tom had the house, and we were all kind of, you know, it was kind of like a punk rock Monkeys kind of, you know, but
sure,
a little crazier. And he had his roommates, and we, you know, we were just in and out, but we were always, yeah,
chilling at Tom's.
Yeah.
So you make these connections with these bands coming through Portland, you're opening for them, they're staying with y'all. Eventually y'all get on the road and everything. You know, when would you say is the first time that you're like, oh, like there's some attention on us. You know, maybe we should take this around the country.
Well, we kind of had everything we needed here. You know, it was our home base, and you know, we were the most, like I say, we're the most responsible people. We were all, you know, we're young alcoholics and, you know, crazy. And, you know, so we didn't, you know, none of us, we would go down to San Francisco and do some small tours, but that was kind of maybe a year or so later. We would start going over to, you know, like you said, bands would come through, and we knew bands from Salt Lake City and Boise and Denver and Reno or wherever. So we would map these little tours out, and we would do those. But the, you know, when we would come back, it would just like the, you know, the band would be on fire, like smoking by the time we were up to Portland. Cause they were like, you know, death marches. So,
and those are long drives too. It's not like the East Coast where you can hit like 4 scenes and like, you know, a really like, you know, they're 4 hours apart from one another. If that, you know, out here, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like 8-hour drive to like the next city, 12-hour, you know, type thing. So it's like, you're definitely putting the van through the ringer.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like in the East Coast in Europe, it got years later where we were actually playing 2 shows a day. We would play like a festival in some country and then drive later to play later that night someplace else, you know? So
right.
That was right. All the relaxing and sloughing around we did in our music, and then we kind of paid for it double when we got older. We're like,
that time right, later.
Time to turn up the heat now.
So initially in these early years, you're just kind of playing like regionally, sort of like in like the Northwest.
Yeah, you know, like I say, in San Francisco and, you know, later in L.A. I mean, like, Pusshead brought us down to San Francisco because he was a big fan. He, you know, he's from Boise, so he would come, Septic Death would come here a couple times and play, and they'd all stay with us. So we got to be really good friends with Pusshead, and then he moved to San Francisco, and he's like, you guys have to come down here and play down here. And that's about the time when, you know, we got a new rhythm section. It was like the long-haired kids, and the crossover thing started kind of being blowing up then. So we would go down and play with, like, you know, Sacrilege, the Melvins, the Accused.
Hell yeah.
Type of, you know,
great stuff.
Yeah. So we were doing that stuff with whoever RKL and stuff, and we kind of got in that. So that was a whole, it's weird because the whole flavor and attitude and stuff would just kind of evolve and change over the years. You know, what was first was just like the aggressive, fast blast, 30-second songs, the skate punk rock stuff, and then it evolved to this, and then you saw like the crossover with the the high tops and the Metallica stuff came in. Yep. And then and then that kind of the back to the English stuff again, and then back to the crust thing came in eventually, and this and
oh
this.
Yeah,
and it was all sorts of that just it evolved. It just kind of, it was like a living, growing thing that just,
ever changing. By the time you get down to LA, like what year is it? Is it as late as like 86 or
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was later than that even. We didn't.
Interesting. I can't remember
the first couple times we hit LA.
Was it kind of in like the War All the Time period or was it sort of Kings of Punk era?
It was around War All the Time.
Okay, so as late as like 87 or so.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. This is interesting too, because it's like, albeit that you guys, Poison Idea, started in kind of like Gen 1, like hardcore punk. By 87, it's like, historically, you're kind of on to like Gen 2. But this is your first time kind of branching out like that far south or something. So it's like, what was kind of like the scene down there in 87 from your memory?
Well, LA was already 10 years into it.
Yeah.
By then. And I just remember like playing like Fenders and it was a lot of gangs, a lot of people. You had like your Suicidals, the gangs, like the Lads or whoever, and the Skinheads, and then like so there was like a lot of different gangs. When we played Fenders, that's when we got into it with the Skinheads, though, that show. They were fucking with us, and I think I threw like a glass pitcher off the stage at him and cracked one of them. And then I just said, and I just went in.
Right.
And I jumped in the crowd and they, started putting the boots to me and stuff. But it was weird because I didn't really, I don't know if I was used to, getting punched out or what. But
just getting into it, people.
Yeah. And it didn't really hurt. And I remember being on the ground thinking, oh, I'm going to get killed. And then we got up and started sorting them out, and it was a big thing. But luckily there was some big bouncers and big, that's when the Suicidals were, a lot of them were bounce security too.
It was a big fight,
but, it was at that time in Los Angeles, there were a lot of places, things were bloodbaths, and it fucked up, whatever scene I guess if you have thousands and thousands of people, you can afford to, kind of like a war, I guess you can afford the cannon fodder, but it wasn't, it's like when the hardcore thing happened, when I got into it, there were a lot of women, there were a lot of artists, there were a lot of gay people, there were everybody, people of color. When the hardcore thing kicked in, that kind of filtered that out.
Yeah.
Those people either left or didn't want to stick around, or I would see people show up to shows that I would never saw before. I'd see some Asian kid show up, and I was like, I'm in a leather jacket. And I was like, wow, I've never seen him before. And as I was looking at him, somebody'd walk up to him and pow. And then I'd go, well, you'll never see him again either.
Yeah.
So it was like that.
That's, and that's the thing too, is that it's funny you bring that up. Cause it's like, even when me being, like I'm born around this time period you're talking about. I'm born in 89 and I got in hardcore in like the mid 2000s. And even when I first started going to gigs and stuff like that, it's a lot of guys, like a lot of white dudes. And that was just kind of like what it was sort of canon at the time. And I feel like only within the past 5 to 7 years have I really seen it turn back to kind of what you're talking about, like towards kind of like being like, you know, like people like that are like, you know, like gay people and like minor, like more like minority involvement and things like that. So it is interesting how you saw that shift happen as opposed to like getting into it. And that was already sort of like kind of like the norm. And now, was it like that in Portland as well? Or were you just kind of, did you start seeing that as you like ventured to other places?
No, it was like that in Portland too. But you know what? It was also, that was just with that scene.
Yeah.
You could always just get out of it and do something else. And it also depended on where you were. I mean, LA had that, but there was also other stuff going on in LA, and same with San Francisco. That was, you know, there was the big violent shit going on there, but also just step outside of it a little bit. And there's stuff just as exciting and just as, you know, exciting and
energetic, what have you.
Yeah. And they accept that stuff. You know, sure. there was always like, you know, either, the, you know, anti-scrunny faction, L7, Frightwig.
Sure, all that
stuff, all that stuff was just always, you know, and that wasn't
like a really step hard. Away. Yeah.
It wasn't really hardcore, but it was, to me, it was just as punk. It was just as punk.
For sure.
So, you know,
I'm looking at the timeline here and everything, and I, you know, we kind of come up, it's like you guys are starting to kind of venture out or whatever. Talk to me a little bit. There's a few year gap in between. I mean, I know you guys end up doing like some 7 inches in like 88 and like 89. I mean, you guys got a ton of records. It's something that's on the horizon that I'm very interested in because it's my favorite Poison Idea record. Is talk to me about leading up into Field of Darkness.
Well, we, you know, it was just, like I said, natural progression. We just kept writing songs and, you know, you have to put them out somehow. I mean, we're playing them live and, you know, every song I Feel in the Darkness is different. We, you know, and every, like you say, the scene's changing and the mood of, you know, our lives are changing and we're changing and we're, you know, evolving and listening to different stuff. And, you know, I can go through like every song on Feel the Darkness and kind of remember what we were doing is, you know, like I wrote them, you know, like Plastic Bomb. I remember writing that. I remember writing the song Feel the Darkness because, you know, we were kind of starting to, our partying was kind of getting cranked up a notch. We were always like crazy alcoholics, but you know, you can only drink so much before you get really sick of drinking. So you're like, well, let's add a little bit of this into it too. Let's take a little bit of this. This will push up the, you know, a little more. And so, like, I had a friend who she got murdered by this. She was a prostitute, and she got murdered by this fucker and tortured. And so, I wanted to pay tribute to her, so I wrote the song "Feel the Darkness" because it was kind of like me, my way of doing therapy to talk about this, to get this out, because it's pretty sad. And so, you know, and then we were on tour. We went out to the East Coast right before Feel the Darkness, and Tom said, so Sub Pop wants us to do a single on their singles club, their monthly singles club. And they were doing like, you know, Jesus Lizard, Dwarves, shit like that, Nirvana, all that stuff was coming out. And so Tom's like, well, you should write a song. And so I was like, okay, Sub Pop, what should it be? Let me think. And I was like, okay, well, give me a guitar. So I went next door in the hotel room and I wrote Taken by Surprise. And I did that, you know, in like 10 minutes. Cause I thought, what would be a good single? What would sound like a single? You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like discontent. You want to write a song that you're so pissed off about these Nazis and ruining your scene, and you're so mad and you're just going to explode. What song represents the way you feel? What would sound like this? Well, it's got to sound like a war going on. It's got to sound like a fucking explosion. It's got to be so mad, just rage, just 100%. just anger, just screaming at these people. So that was that idea and that sound. That's what, you know, if you want to write a rock song, it's got to have a beat like this. It's got to be a, you know, a, you know, I was, like I'm saying, I'm going through every song and feeling the darkness. We were in New York and I was with my friends in this band, Big Stick. They're kind of like Thrill Kill Cult in a way.
Okay, sure.
And but they're rock and rollers still, even though they, you know, their music's, you know, like kind of like techno.
Electronic, they, yeah.
Yeah, and he was saying, John was saying, he's like, why don't you write just a rock and roll song, like an old fashioned kick ass Blue Oyster Cult, you know? I'm in my car and I'm fucking driving off the cliff and I'm just like, fuck everybody. It's like, I got my girl on my head. I'm drinking whiskey. It's like rock and roll, the old fashioned yeah. rock and roll, you yeah. know? So I'm like, okay. So I'm like, okay. Okay. So I think it should start like this. And then I wrote, you know, that's what I wrote, you know, Taken by Surprise. I was just like, or Just to Get Away, excuse me. Or Just to Get Away.
Because it's, amazing it's like that, track.
That song, just like, it's just like, this is, you know,
and it sounds like that. It sounds like what you're talking about.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's the way, you know, that's what a song should be. If you, you know, if you are in pain, make it like a screaming out pain. If you're happy, you know, a Buzzcock song that just, it, you know, has this emotion, it sounds like that. You can hear it and you know what it feels like. And it makes you feel like that too. So that's kind of with that album, that was just the way it came about, you know?
I mean, and I, like, while I remember it, Sam wanted me to ask you a question about discontent. And you talk about how the song's like a war, like, you know, like between two sides kind of thing. Is like, did you all the vocals on that track, correct?
Yeah.
So it's like, cause there's parts on that song where you're like doing a completely different vocal than you normally do. It's like a lot harsher. And Sam was like, yo, it kind of sounds like the dude from Anti-Simex. And he's like, I wonder if that guy sang on there or something. But no, I mean, I was like, I don't know, man. I feel like this whole thing's Jerry, and he's just going particularly hard on these parts. But it makes sense because it you're talking about it being like a war. It's almost like you have the voices of two different sides on like an issue or something. You know,
sure,
like
figuratively. Yeah. It's like channeling things, you know, energies. You know, Tom said sometimes, like, doing shows, it would be so, the feeling would get like tribal, and we would start to conjure this, you know, the crowd would be surging and the chaos and the music and the smoke and the feel in the air. And Tom would go, you know what? He goes, you were like flying around on stage. He goes, I looked over at you and you were like levitating off the stage. Like, I could see you like just like floating for like just like 2 seconds. Like, I saw you just rise off the ground, and I was like, I'm in like in a trance, you know, I'm doing this. Yeah. I'm just like, you know, out of it. And he's like, yeah, it's like magic. It's like crazy. You're just like evoking this, you know, crazy.
I mean, that's so awesome. Like, and so that comes out, and now that record, like it was on Vinyl Solution, but you did a single for Sub Pop, and that was just a single. They didn't do a record for you.
No, that was just the record, the monthly single club, you know, where you'd give them like whatever $50, and they'd send you a single every month. Like, you know, like L7 did one, and mm-hmm. I think a Rollins band did one, and
makes sense.
You know, yeah.
Oh, definitely. And so during this time period, at this point, you guys have gotten like, you've been a band for a while. I mean, rolling up on almost 10 years, but you, like, only within the past few of those are you guys kind of like getting out into the world at physically. At this point, you know, like, is this becoming like a full-time like job for you guys, or are you still just kind of like getting it in when you can?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we couldn't survive just playing the music and stuff, and you know, we all had like jobs, whatever. I've had lots of jobs, you know, cooking, dishwashing, bartending, whatever. Sure. You know, and we all pretty much did that too, you know.
Okay.
Tom was a drug dealer. He sold drugs. Yeah. And what else is he gonna do, you know? Plus he did it since he was a kid, so. And yeah.
Got it. So, because I was trying to kind of figure out like the operation, like, you know, like at this time, because it's like with like a lot of those Gen 1 bands, it was either like, I feel like it was either they were out 300 out of 365 days a year, or it was more kind of like y'all's operation where it was like, oh, you know, like we get this in when we can, you know, type scenario. So, you know, you guys are, you know, hitting it or whatever. And what's interesting is that, like, by this point, a lot of stuff from the era that y'all come from is either breaking up or like completely changing, or has been broken up, that, because it's like, I don't think Black Flag's a band anymore. At this point, it's like Bad Brains obviously is, but they've sonically, they've changed into something else. You know, all the Boston stuff is completely different at this time. You know, and so what was kind of like that, like being like an OG, like we talked about, like at the kind of like the beginning, and kind of like experiencing sort of like this larger umbrella of the world changing around you?
Well, you know, I just recently wrote a book that came out. And I explained in that what it took me a while to, you know, you live and you just kind of let nature push you in this direction, and you don't know until you stop and you step out of the situation and look at it from, you know, with fresh eyes and look and see what you're doing and why you're doing these things. And like I say, we were just at that time, we loved playing that music. It was, you know, in our blood. We did it for years. We loved doing it, and we really didn't know anything else. And that's pretty much, yeah, at that time, it's like I say, it took me a long time to look at what we were doing and why we did it. And I can tell you exactly everything, you know, why. I even say it in the book, you know, it's like after Feel the Darkness and Blank Blackout, where there's a, funny enough, there's a, says nihilism on the back of the cover, and it explains what it is. And that's kind of at that time, that's how we were living, to become, you just become nothing. It's like, I just want to fade out and just disappear. I want to be so, you know, just become nothing, nothingness. And then there was a time we started, like I said, we started doing drugs. We, three of us were full-time like drug addicts, dependent on drugs. And that was at the end where we kind of started just playing to stay high, to be, we played some really bad shows. And then right before Tom passed away, I was like, you know what? I feel like we've let people down and lied to people, because we're kind of doing this thing where it's like fucking people, it's kind of like the germs, people come to see you die, or Johnny Thunders, they come to see you die first. And I was like, you know what? I want to get our shit together and get sober and go out there and just, you know, cause we can do this. We've written this huge catalog of material, and I just want to blow the doors off everything for like a year straight, year, maybe 2 years, just roll over it. And that's kind of what we did at the end. Last 2 years, we just, I mean, it was back to being like the old days again. It was like untouchable. We just rolled through and just, you know, we toured like nonstop. And then when we were done, we just like, okay, we proved our point. And we're like, here you go, you know. And that's what happened at the end, you know.
And, like, and this is like what, 90, like... 94, 95?
Well, because what happened was in 94, 95, we did the tour, that big tour of Europe, and Tom was so strung out that he just said, he's like, I need to go home. I can't tour anymore. He's like, damn. We were like copping drugs in every city we were at. We were going over international borders, like smuggling heroin into these fucking places. We were doing some, you know, we were... You know, shit was, it was crazy. The stuff, our lives, the stuff that was going on, you know, some of us were having, you know, big federal charges against us for like trafficking dope and getting caught, sending it, you know, in the mail.
Yeah.
And all these things were happening. And then, you know, we were, like I said, we were all strung out and we were in one of the most sketchiest places in this craziest, you know, whatever city we're in, like Berlin or, you know, it was some, just the shit, the stories, the stuff I remember, you know, we're like trying to play in whatever, like someplace in Germany and the, we're looking for drugs and the guy's like, okay, you got to go to this really bad part of town, go into this bar. And if you see the blonde girl in there, she'll be with the man. You go up to the man and you say, would you like to come in the bathroom with me? And you're like, really? That's what I have to do? And so you put yourself in these situations where you would do that.
Yeah.
And of course you would get the wrong person. And they're looking at you like, what are you saying? They go, you know, you want to come in the bathroom with me? The guy's like, what are you fucking talking about? And, you know, and these things, it's just like something out of a movie where these just like this, it's funny, but it's like pathetic and it's scary and it's,
yeah,
you know, and it's sure. Like, yeah. And that kind of shit is just like common everyday stuff, you know, and you're driving and you see, you're looking at the blue water, you know, you see Monte Carlo and you're like, oh my God, it's fucking Monte Carlo. Look at how beautiful that is. And you look at the guys in the band and every single guy is just like slobbering on themselves. They don't keep their eyes open. And you're just like, this is horrible. So that was in 94.
Yeah.
And then, Tom came back and quit and, we didn't play for like 2 years. I did one band. I got really bad. And I saw Tom one day and we were talking. He's like, you know what? We should get Dean and Chris back, the original guys from Pick Your King, and go back and do a New Year's show.
Right.
So we played a show in Portland and it was huge. It was like a couple thousand people. And so that's when kind of he's like, well, let's play some more. And that's kind of right then. That's kind of when we were just playing to stay for money to get fucked up. And we did that for a couple of years, and that's when I started, you know, just the insanity started snowballing. And yeah. Stuff, you know what? I like I said, I wrote this book, and people are just going, I can't believe it. I can't believe
it. What's the name of the book?
It's called Black Heart Fades Blue.
And where can people get it? Because I want to make sure, like, to plug that, like, right here. Like, where can people get that?
Yeah, it's a Rare Bird Books. It's on Amazon. It's on Amazon. You can get it. I should have, you know, I don't know why I didn't bring one here. They got a box of them out there. But it's pretty, it's, you know, the people are reading and they write me every day and they're just go, I can't believe this. I can't believe this shit. That,
crazy.
It happened. Yeah. And it's like, well, there's a happy ending. I live.
You're here.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? Not everybody is. And that's the thing, you know, like, you know, Steve Hanford, you know, he, the drummer Slayer hippie, held up some pharmacies. He got so strung out on pills that he held up three pharmacies.
Yeah.
And he, you know, went to federal prison and Tom died from that. And, everybody just, yeah. And people are just, you know, that's what happens. If you stare into the abyss long enough, it will stare back at you.
That's true. Yeah. So during this time period, you're kind of referencing where you're just kind of playing for drug money. Like, is that like, what is this, like the late 90s? Like, or I'm just trying to get my timeline.
Yeah. Late 90s up until, you know, and then we kind of started throwing together different lineups just to do shit. And then Tom came back and we did Latest Will and Testament. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't that bad of a record. It was supposed to be a demo. And we were demoing, but this label in Germany liked it and they wanted to put it out. So I think it was Farewell, maybe.
And that came, let's see, it looks like it says here, that was a Farewell, correct? Yes.
What year that was?
It says here 2006.
Yeah, it was pretty, it was late, yeah, it was way later.
So what were you doing kind of in the time period where you guys weren't releasing records and like from like, let's say like 98 to then?
What was I doing?
Yeah.
Shit. Oh yeah. Just like I say, craze going crazy. You know, getting involved in all sorts of really hardcore stuff.
Really?
Being homeless for a little while, doing crazy shit. Trying to stay alive, but just hustling and just, you know, being a bad person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, I mean, the thing is like, you're here now and you're able to look back at, like, say, like, this low point in your life, and you're able to say, like, hey, like, I wasn't the best dude then, you know, and you were able to come back from it. It's kind of like you said earlier, like, a lot of people aren't here now. And so it's good. And at kind of a success story, you're living a success story in this instance, that you can get to a point like that and you can make your way out of it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's not like giving away a secret or nothing, but on the book, the first page it says this was a suicide note that failed, because that's kind of how it started. I was like writing out, like, when it started, when Tom passed away, and I started hearing these people go, oh, I saw him, you know, throw a refrigerator out a window this one time and blah, blah, this stuff. And I was like, that's not true. I was there. And they're like, I saw it. You can't tell me what I didn't see. So I was like, well, you know what? I'm right behind Tom. I'm going to be right behind him. And these people are going to say this stuff about me too. So I'm going to sit down and write this out the way I saw it. And then I kind of planned on just being what nihilists do and just fading away. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I just knew that I was not going to be here, because I accepted that. And I was happy with that. I was content with that. And I sat down and I wrote this, and then right when I was finishing, I finished it, and then something happened. I met somebody, and this person who didn't know who I was, never heard of my band, didn't know anything about punk rock, and she's like, yeah, you know, you can, that's bullshit, you can do whatever you want, you know. And I was like, wow. So it's when you least expect it, you know, it's a crazy ride.
When did kind of like this sort of, let's say, positive turn occur?
Well, like I said, I was getting ready to, you know, to put this all to rest, like, 3 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and when we will arrive there, because there's, you know, space in between. But so, you know, you were having this hard time in the early 2000s. You guys, you know, get together, you know, to do this record in 2006. Like, were you guys like playing a lot at that time, or was it the kind of thing where you just, like, you know, like when you could, or not at all?
Yeah, when we could. And like I say, I felt disappointed, you know. I felt, because, like, we would do some tours of Europe and stuff, and, you know, it would be kind of shitty, and I could, there'd be like kids walking behind me, and they're going, you know, what's wrong, Jerry? Did you not have your heroin today? Why are you feeling so? Why are you so shitty? What's wrong with you? Why are you doing?
Fuck.
You know, and I just, like, you know, yeah, I feel bad, because I feel like I was, you know. And so, yeah, and then we got, and then so I got some other old guys back, and we did a couple records. We did the Confuse and Conquer for Southern Lord.
Yep.
And, you know, that's held up. That was pretty good. But you know what? Then we got our shit together. We got, like I say, I think it was a success for me, because I got some people back in the last 2 years. We stopped playing 2 years ago. And that was, like I said, we did, you know, I met my wife, and she, and when I met her, I was like, well, you know, I know this is going to happen, but I have to take care of this last bit of business before. Yeah. And she didn't know anything about it. She's like, what, you know, what do you mean on tour? What are you doing? Where are you going? So it's crazy. If I didn't write it down and look at it, you would never believe that it happened.
It is interesting that, like, you know, it took meeting somebody that was like, I have no idea who you are. And, you know, like, to, and, you know, and that might be, you know, the key factor in there is it somebody that didn't have like a a preconceived notion about you based off of the kind of like the sort of magnanimous nature of your history and kind of being there since the beginning and like who Poison Idea is and everything. You know, and this, if you don't also, it's like backtrack a little bit before we move forward some here, but you know, if it's, this is something that's like, you don't want to talk about, you know, whatever, I understand. But when did Tom pass?
Do you have a date there?
I don't necessarily. It's like I was just just from your recollection. So it said 2006. So that record had come out, and he must have passed soon after.
Yeah, I mean the record came out, and we kind of had like a tribute to Tom inside of it.
Right. Okay. So that it kind of happened in the kind of the process there. I see. Yeah. All right. Cause I was trying to get the timeline, like kind of like figured out there, you know, what did, was it the kind of thing where like when that happened, were you like immediately like, oh, like, I mean, Tom's been here like practically, I know he wasn't there the whole time, but practically since the beginning, should we stop? Or was it the kind of thing where you're like, oh, it's not what Tom would have wanted? Like how did you approach the band at that point?
Well, I kind of found him when he passed. Yeah. And I sat and kind of talked to him, you know, and I was like, cause he kind of set himself up to do that. And, so I was, you know, asking him if this is what he really wanted. And, if this is what you wanted, look what you got, because it's nothing. It's, you really you got what you wanted. This is horrible. This is it, you know? And, then,
painful.
Yeah. And then, so we just kind of, like I said, that's kind of about the time that I felt like, you know what, we should, come back and start trying to get our shit together a little more.
I see. A catalyst.
Yeah, and you know what? It's like I kind of started going in that direction, but then by that time, all the energy that we attracted and our years of doing this one thing, there was no way that I was going to shake it overnight. And the people that were with me that were playing, they were already deep in that lifestyle too. And since then, a few of them have passed too, because they got on board with us. And, you know, they wanted to live like we did, and it sucked them in too. And they, you know, the same thing happened to them.
Right.
Yeah. And so, right. Like I said, there was a time where I just figured that, you know, this was going to be it. It was a trip. It was a surprise that I didn't, you know, never would have thought it.
And people are happy for it, man. Like I'm happy to be speaking to you right now. Like, it's not every day that you get to speak to somebody, you know, of your bona fides, of your kind of like authentic, original, you know, nature, whatever, because a lot of people of that time period are not around anymore. So, and I know people are, regardless if you're making music now or not, are happy that you are. I know that like you said, like a couple years ago that you decided to stop even before the pandemic occurred, you had decided to stop doing Poison Idea. How had you kind of arrived at that place?
Well, that's what I said. I wanted to come back, and I wanted to end this. I wanted to give the people a good, I wanted to come back and play really well, do good shows, do some recordings, kind of a tone.
I saw you in that time period, and you guys were very, very good. So like you succeeded there, at least when I saw you.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to blow the doors off it and come back and then just say thank you.
Cool.
Say thank you for everything. Kind of apologize and say thank you at the same time. So
I'm thinking about it now. It's like, you know, now that you haven't been doing that for a couple of years, even with kind of like there not being like live music for a certain time period, are you doing anything musically now, or you have any interest, or is it just something where you're like, okay, I did that for most of my life, and I don't want to do that anymore?
Well, you know, like, bless you. In this book I wrote that before I was born, before I even talked, I was singing these little songs. I could, because I was born in the early 60s, and that's like when the Beatles and the Beach Boys were on the radio, and that's when radio was a big part of life. So before I spoke my first word, which was Vietnam, my mother told
crazy.
Me and I said, that I was actually singing like Beach Boys, like, oh, little kids singing along to Beach Boys songs.
Yeah.
So I've always done that. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy doing it. And I've played with a couple bands since then, just like set in with people. I did some stuff with this band Soft Kill in Portland.
Oh, they're outstanding. I'm a fan. Yeah.
I did stuff with them. I'm doing this stuff with this band in Belgium called Crime Scene, and they're pretty rock. They sound like 80s metal. They sound like 80s metal.
Hell yeah. I'll check it out.
And so we're going to be playing, we're doing some festivals in Europe like in November.
Cool.
Yeah. So I'm just, you know what? Just keep living and doing whatever, you know. I love playing music. I was playing music Sunday in the studio again.
Yeah. So, are you recording something, or are you just kind of?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Always playing stuff, you know?
So, gotcha. Gotcha. So people have things to look forward to from you. It's not like you're totally tapped out.
Nah, I mean, you know what? It's natural for people to create and to do stuff. I do stuff all the time. I do art, I paint, I cook, I garden, I play music, we swim, I walk, just live. It's time to live, man. It's, you know, I get out and I just love it. I love being alive now, so I'm just enjoying everything.
That's beautiful, man. That's legitimately warms my heart to hear that. And I think that's probably a good place to kind of like leave things, where it's like, you know, you're loving life and you're living, and everybody I know that's listening is really happy to hear that. I want to thank you for coming on, man. This has been really special to me. I know it's gonna be a lot, like, really special to a lot of our listeners. And I really look forward to, you know, being able to connect with you again.
Thank you, Ace.
All right. Have a good one, sir. Everybody out there, thanks for listening to Form of Passion. Stay safe.
Cheers.